harvest be surely come. A dry summer didn't come before.
All right, welcome to WPKN's Organic Farm Stand, which comes to you the first and third Thursday of each month from 12 to 1. My name is Richard Hill. I'm here with Chris Ferriero, co-host, and our itinerant farmer, Guy Beardsley, who is on the phone with us. Guy, are you there?
I am. Thank you very much.
Great to hear you.
Unfortunately, Janelle is not here.
Yeah.
And that's one of my really basic sources of all sorts of good information. But she's teaching her fourth grade class up in Newtown right now.
Oh, so that's very interesting. I wish we have time maybe to have find out a little bit of how that's going, because, of course, the education situation in the state and nationally is so
patchwork. Well, she is a great herb and flower individual, but right now she's got fourth grade in Waldorf School up in Newtown, which is really great. Anyway, we got plenty of things going on here.
Yeah, let me, before we get to your report, mention what we're going to be doing today. We have a special guest, and I want to thank you, Guy, for initiating this production, because you called Dina Brewster at CT NOFA. She's executive director there. And Dina said, you got to get this special person on the air ASAP. And that person is Zephra Alexander. And she is has her own sort of project she's pursuing, which has to do with seed saving and biodiversity and the connection between wild or forested land and farmland, and the importance of saving seeds to our survival as a species, but also as the sustainability of the entire planet. Zephra Alexander will be joining us in about 10 or 15 minutes here. And I believe she's still up in Vermont, so she'll give us a little perspective from there. But a fantastic thing. It's on the CT NOFA website under the heading of the Ecotype Project. So you can all look for that on the ctnofa.org site. So, Guy Beardsley, yes, we are mourning the absence of Janelle, who has been just a fantastic addition to our team here over the past, I'm going to say, 6-8 months. She brings so much, as you said, knowledge, but also just the energy, the good vibes, and her fantastic ideas, which have gone into the production of this show. I hope we'll still be able to call on her for some of that.
Well, I hope so, too, because, anyway, I talk with her every day because she comes back here and sort of supervises the herbs and flowers. Of course, they are now in the business of retreating, because we got the equinox here shortly within the week, and we're not going to have a whole lot of growth on almost anything except the kale and some of the other things like the lettuces, so that they can continue to give us a good production. Am I on now at this point, Richard?
Yeah, you're on. I just want to mention that Chris is here, and I want to make sure we got him on. Why is he not? Yeah, I don't understand.
Mike,
as you.
Mike 2, maybe? Here we go.
Oh, Mike 2. What are you doing over there?
I think it's Mike 2.
Yeah, okay. I thought you were going to.
Oh, run. There he is.
Yeah,
there's.
Hey,
there.
Guy.
Hi, Chris.
And we're going to miss Janelle for a while.
Yeah, we do. I miss her all the time, but she's got a great job. She's been teaching for years, and it's an interesting job, because when the teacher picks up a class, and she's picked up the fourth grade class, she'll keep that class all the way up to the eighth grade. And so the same teacher stays with the class. That means that teacher has to adapt year to year for all the different things that students have to pick up by year to year. That's the mathematics, the English, and so right now she's they're fourth graders. They're putting on a play, and that's amazing. And she's only got two boys in the class, and so some of the girls are going to have to play parts of the boys. not a big thing, of course, but that's just an interesting event.
That's funny, but I'm very curious to know how they're navigating the situation with the schools, because I think each school district has its own plan. Waldorf is obviously not a public school, but they have to sort of plot out their own strategy, because there is at the beginning no national strategy for schools, and then the states, I think, are leaving it up to districts and even individual towns to develop their own protocols for how they're going to navigate this coronavirus.
Yeah, the governor has let the individual towns and school systems develop their own strategies. You're right.
Yeah. So it'd be interesting to hear how that goes at that one particular school. So, Guy, tell us a little bit more about the landscape that we're experiencing now. It's amazing how quickly the season changed. I mean, it's not like we've had cold weather, but it's definitely cooler. There's a kind of of course, our air now is hazy and polluted from the West Coast fires, but there's a definite sort of film over everything, you know, which I associate with an early fall. And I wonder what it looks like there up in the White Hills.
Like it's a great fall so far. We could use a little rain, but I think we probably, you know, there's always something that you can use more of or less of, such as the case may be. But we got 1.7 inches of rain so far this month. It has come in small buckets at the time, but we're really not in any big terrific drought at all. And so we've been able to get out there in the fields and do good work. I've got my garlic fields all prepared, although I don't have, I've got them. I actually, I went ahead and put a turn bottom plow in there, and I've got that all set up. I got some rocks, which I unfortunately turned up, which I got to get out of there. But beyond that, we're going to put some good green manure crop in there of oats, peas, and vetch, and then we'll turn it under around the 1st of November, and then the 13th, 14th, and 15th, wait a second, that's not too quick, it's the 11th, 12th, and 13th of November where we'll be planting our garlic. That's the root days, according to the Stella Natura calendar, and if we miss that, we can go the 20th and the 21st. Before Thanksgiving, we get that garlic in the ground, and so we'll be okay. I got to say that the garlic cookers we've had now for 5 years, and they came from China, and they're not giving us a consistent response. I don't quite understand what's happening, but we have layers in these cookers, and we put the garlic bulb in. After it's been trimmed from the roots and the stalk. And so, you know, these different shelves are giving me different responses. Like I took last week, I took the top garlic off of the top shelf, and it was fine. But the second shelf down there was a little overdone. And so right now we have to check the garlic cookers individually each time we look at them. You got to go into both shelves. There's two shelves in each cooker, and so if anybody is making black garlic from cookers, that's something that you need to do, depending upon the cooker you're using. The only cookers we got 5 years ago that we could find were comes from China, and they have subsequently developed some idiosyncrasies which we can't quite figure out, except we know that as of about 6 days in the cooker, we have to check them daily, because in some cases the garlic on one shelf will be ready, but it will not be ready on the second shelf. So they have to be checked at least once a day from the sixth to eighth on, in order to make sure that when you find the garlic that is ready, that you get it out of there, and then you can put another one in there. And it was by shelf. In one case, one cooker, the both shells are pretty good, but all the others, they're a little bit different. So it's an interesting development, but I'm not sure how we're going to handle that, except I don't want to spend the money on go ahead and buying a whole bunch of new cookers. But maybe we'll have to do that. Depends upon how we go. Now, we got some great fall raspberries right now. That's one of the good things that you can get. The red raspberries are really good, great, delicious flavor. Only trouble, you have to be very careful because the hornets like them as well as you do, as well as we do. And the hornet considers the raspberry it's their raspberry, and so they get a little upset if you start to pick that raspberry. And, of course, they'll burn you when you give them a chance. But nevertheless, that's all good, and we can live with that. Right.
Guy, when did you complete the garlic harvest, or is it in fact completed?
Well, the garlic harvest was out of the ground on the middle of July. By the middle of July, we had it all out of the ground. Mm-hmm. But then we lay it out flat in the barn, so out of the sun, and it's although it was pretty hot this year, we keep the barn doors open, and so they get plenty of ventilation. I do not put a fan on them. But it's not necessary. And so we lay them out without just a single layer, and keep them as cool, dry, and dark as we can. And they will be cured in about 10 days, a week to 10 days. And so that at that point, you can use them just like fresh garlic, or you can put them, trim them up and put them in the cookers. That's pretty much how we handle the garlic.
So Guy, all the garlic you end up cooking? All the garlic you harvest?
No. We're always selling it too, selling the fresh garlic.
Right.
So between the we put in 6,000-foot rows, which are pretty 1,000-foot. No, I guess 600-foot rows. And so anyway, we have a lot of garlic. And so we can sell, we keep a fresh garlic supply in the store, mm-hmm. as well as try to keep the black garlic in there. It's a little difficult to keep the black garlic in there because there's a big demand for it. And although I don't advertise, lots of folks do come by and want the garlic. Some call advance, some don't. So we try to keep garlic. We got 5 cookers. One of which we're very cautious with, but one of them which still works pretty good. The others we have to check on a daily basis once they get about 6 days into the cooking process. I hope that answers that question a little bit.
Sure, and also you're saving garlic for planting too.
Absolutely, and that's an interesting point because what I look for in a planting garlic are good-sized cloves. Now, I know with a bulb, if a good-sized clove comes in a good-sized bulb, that's the best combination. But if you get a good-sized cloves are more important because that's what you really do plant. And if you put good-sized cloves in, as opposed to these little slivers which come in some of the particularly, and I don't grow this anymore, but some of the soft neck garlic would put out a whole bunch of real sliver cloves, and I don't think they're worth planting. They just don't seem to produce anything that's useful. Anyway, we're looking for the big cloves. Yeah, they can come from small bulbs, not really tiny bulbs, but small bulbs. And but the good-sized cloves are what we will plant. And I'll leave them in the bulb up until about the middle of October. From the middle of October, then we start to pull them apart and segregate them by size and have them available for planting. So when we plant them, when I plant them in a row, I like to keep the same size bulb in that row so that, and we mark the row so we know which row is which. And so at the end, we'll have some really small bulbs or small cloves We can identify those, and we know we're going to have to increase the fertilization or spread them out a little bit longer, spread them out a little bit more so that they have a chance to grow to their maximum.
What's the spacing between the planting of the cloves?
Well, I like to keep about 8 to 10 inches. And I know in some pieces that's a little bit more than most people put in. But I had some workers that put them in at about 5 to 6 inches last year, and they're going to come out a little bit smaller. I like to give the bulb plenty of chance, get those roots to go out, and so that they don't intertwine with one another. So I try to keep it between 8 to 10 inches between cloves.
Which is why you produce garlic the size of grapefruits.
Oh, no, I don't do that. That would be a variation on elephant garlic, and I don't fool with that at all.
Okay.
No, we go with strictly German red, German porcelain, and Music. Right, and of course there's a huge number of other kinds of garlic you could put in. There's Polish, there's Czechoslovakian, there's Hungarian, my goodness, all sorts of things. And you can look at the Johnny's catalog and see all the different kinds of garlic. I only plant my own garlic for good reasons, and I think we'll probably pick this up on the Seed Savers discussion, because with your own garlic, it is adjusted to your soil and your climate, and I think that is very important. I remember taking some Music from Michigan, and the first year it didn't do at all well, so I replanted the same cloves, which were small, the same bulbs, and the next year they were bigger, and then by the third year they were a good size. But that's an interesting observation, I thought, in your garlic, because it does need to adapt to your soil and fertilizer and your and our climate.
One last question on this, Guy. Is there, when you replant this November, are you going to use the same rows that you
No,
used?
I always vary it. No, I won't plant in the same area, but once every 4 years.
Oh, okay. Wow, that's...
Yeah, in the meantime, we might plant some potatoes in there, but for the most part, we'll just plant and keep a good cover crop on it. Mm-hmm. We do have a lot of really great clover comes up, and my brother says if you fertilize any of our ground around here, the clover will suddenly appear like it's never been there before, but all of us, so we have a lot of good clover. Most of it is Ladino white clover, but there is some pink clover also, and that has seemed to come up all by itself, and so we'll mow it down and let it, but once you mow it down, it will regrow. So that's an excellent way to help fertilize the soil.
It's also, I believe, the white clover is an excellent pollinator as well.
Yes, yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Right. And, of course, the bees really love the white clover. We get that out of Vincent, that and the white clover is better than the red clover for the bees.
Yes, indeed. Well, speaking of seed saving and biodiversity and all these topics that we're going to explore, we now have Sephra Alexander on the phone with us. Sephra, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and great to listen about garlic and all the great seeds that exist in our living seed banks and seed profiles, like that white clover.
Yeah, I just want to mention that when I spoke to you a couple of days ago, you picked up the phone. Hi, it's Sephra. I'm up here, you know, doing my seed thing. And I said, where are you? And you said, you're just about to step into a canoe at the headwaters of the Connecticut River. And it was a very good connection, so it was hard for me to believe that you were actually about to start penning the rivers of northern, I'm not sure where they are in Vermont, but that was so exciting to hear that, get that little image of you canoeing the headwaters of the Connecticut River. What is going on up there? And tell us about the EcoType project that you're participating in and all about seed saving, biodiversity, and the connection between our wild forested land and our farmland?
Absolutely. Well, I am currently working for CTNOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association, their Connecticut chapter, and I'm the lead of their pollinator health initiative, which we call the Ecotype Project. Now, an ecotype just basically defines the wild genetics of what we have here in our local soils. So we work with botanists who wild collect the seed, and then we work with organic farmers. Right now I'm at the beautiful Hickory Farm in Ridgefield, where we put in founder plots. So we put in 200 plugs, and then we let that go to seed. Just like any other crop, you have to watch the seed for peak ripeness. So at the beginning, the seeds are green, and we wait till they get brown and dark and the pods desiccate or dry out. And I'm actually in the process right now of collecting some beautiful penstemon seed. And then we go forth and we go through the whole cleaning process of it and get it out to the nursery men and women who then make it available to everyone else. They're through plant sales. Aspetuck Land Trust just finished their plant sales. And by working with landscapers and homeowners, what we're doing is we're fortifying these pollinator pathways, right? What we want to do is reduce the fragmentation in between these wild lands by creating these habitat way stations for our pollinators to have what they need. So just like on your great show, we talk about all the heirlooms that we as humans like to caretake. If we put our bug eyes on, we see that our dear friends, the entomological pollinators here who do all the heavy endurance race lifting of making sure we have local food, we need to make sure that they have the heirlooms that they've been caretaking. So when we save seed locally, bioregionally, or what we like to focus on is ecoregions, we are in ecoregion 59, woohoo, which is basically the EPA put out a great map, and they said if we want to really do conservation and stewardship, we need to be looking not at Massachusetts and Connecticut boundaries. We need to be looking at these habitat mosaics of where the riparian corridors are, of where the broadleaf forests are. So there's a beautiful map that kind of illustrates this with a broad painterly brush of overlays of soil structures and forest structures and hydrology and geology to say that if you collect the genetics anywhere in ecoregion 59, you can proliferate those seeds, and that's what those insects and pollinators want where they are. So we're putting the right plants back in the right place. So being an endurance race ethnobotanist, ethnobotany is the study of humans and their interactions with the plants around them. I formulated the botanical expedition. So not botanical, but botanical. So instead of a botanist, I'm now a lead botanist. And what we just did was paddled 87 miles of the Great Connecticut River. The indigenous spelling of that word means the long tidal river. So as you said, the headwaters are up there on the Canadian border, and they go all the way to Long Island Sound. So in terms of like indigenous thoroughfares of where trade routes were, of really important riparian corridors for animals and insects and humans, this is this ancient path that was a real privilege to be on. So we brought 500 ecotype plants that we got from Daryl Newman over at Planner's Choice. And I had 9 other intrepid expeditioners with me. And we paddled 87 miles with those plants and put in a couple ecotype pollinator gardens along that riparian corridor to make sure that those seeds, I love wordsmithing here, and there's a lot of great words that talk about seed dispersal. So anemochory is a fancy word for dispersal of seed by wind. Hydrochory is dispersal of seed by water, and anthropochory is dispersal of seed by humans. So what we were doing as we paddled for the pollinators was we were putting those plants back where they needed to be so that once they go to seed, the wind, the water will put them back in that living seed bank, back in the living seed profile. Because as true stewards and caretakers, what we want to be doing is making sure that the biodiversity of plants is there to support the biodiversity of pollinators, which helps facilitate the entire ecological cycle that ecosystem relies on. So, we had such a great time, and portaging with plants is a pretty hilarious and brilliant endeavor. And we did it with my friends from Spartan Race, so there'll be a little documentary about it, and Patagonia New Haven helped support us. And, as caretakers, we want to take in the beauty of nature, but we don't just want to take, we want to give back. So it was really wonderful to be able to give back and help steward that beautiful riparian area.
Sephra, if I might ask, what is the harm or the devastation, if I'm on the right track here, that you're trying to repair? How did it come that humans had to intervene here to restore or perhaps just, start from scratch and create these riparian corridors, I guess is the word you used. What were the things that caused these things to diminish and decline?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think it's really important to say, when we're talking about the river, those alluvial soils, along that river area, those are some of the best soils in our state and in all the contiguous states that are joined by that river for farming. And the Ecotype Project works largely under a USDA specialty crop block grant, where our specialty crop is actually the production of these truly local native pollinator seeds. And so what we're really trying to emphasize is the importance of having these pollinator habitats on farms, because without these pollinators, there's no produce. And there's what's really great, because a lot of people through the great work of the Pollinator Pathway and other organizations are really understanding that when we cut down all the native wild plants and have these huge lawns, having a little bit of lawn to play on, that's great, but we need to make sure that we're still providing habitat in our home, because we're not just homeowners, we're land stewards. So in your own home, making sure you have room for these pollinators, but especially on our farms, as we've seen with the pandemic and everything, having local food security is so imperative. And if we don't have the food that our pollinators need, well, then we're not going to have the food that we need. So there's a couple different things. So when we make sure that we have these pollinator habitats on the farm, we make sure that we have the native bees, the butterflies. Even at night, we have some great women who have been monitoring the founder plots here, and they go out with headlamps at night, and they're looking for these pollinators that a lot of moths, like on the Rudbeckia, they'll come out and just, there's a whole wild safari that's going on. There's different pollinators that come at different times in the day as the flowers open and close at different times of the season. So there's really a whole cyclical cycle that happens. So I think in terms of you're saying what problem we're trying to address, it's making sure that we have complete pollination on farms by having these pollinators on farm and making sure they have healthy organic habitats to buzz around in. But I think also as people become more, as they become proponents of supporting these pollinator gardens, there's different nurseries out west and in different parts of the country that are great, and they grow a lot of native plants. But the difficulty comes in as we kind of up the ante on this conversation. If you're buying those, even the same species from those different areas, they have been adapted to the terroir, to the local pests, the local climates of where they're grown, which changes their bloom time sometimes. So when we put those plants in our backyards, if you think about the monarchs, if we're talking about endurance racers, basically these monarchs are on an ultra marathon. Their migration is a 5-year cycle. And so even if we have the wrong milkweeds here and it looks like we're supporting the life of a lot of monarchs, if they stay too long because our flowers are blooming too long because they're not from here, they miss moving on in their migration and down the path, they might be somewhere where it's too cold for them then, and then there's actually a large die-off. So we really want to support just making sure that these wild genetics that are here, that they stay wild. And when you bring in seeds from other places and they're growing with the wild seeds, it can kind of help muddle all of that great bioregional adaptation that our plants have been doing for, time since time immemorial, if that helps answer that question.
Safra, this is Chris. I'm the co-host. I just have a question. Well, actually, more of a comment. Like, I ordered some milkweed plants, or milkweed seeds, I should say, and they were specifically native to Connecticut. And like it's a, I can't remember the site where I got them. I was referred there by the Connecticut NOFA site. But I did specifically get seeds made for, you know, plants that are indigenous to Connecticut. So it sounds like that's part of what you're doing. You're trying to stick with the what would you call it? The USDA zone. What did you call that?
Oh, we're Ecoregion 59. Yeah, so we're really trying to promote the concept of ecoregions. And maybe it was Xerxes that you got the seed listed from. But I think one thing that we want to be aware of is we don't want to vilify anyone. Anyone who has pollinator plants in their landscape, that's great. We really want to support that as much as possible. But what we're trying to do is make these ecotype plants more readily available on the commercial market, so that when you go to buy pollinator plants, that, you know, there's the marketing and the knowledge around what truly local natives are and why those are important. So really, from CT NOFA's standpoint, we've been working on facilitating that educational understanding of the why, but certainly don't want it to be a case where if people have beautiful pollinator gardens in their backyard, we don't want them to be ripping those out. We just want them to understand why helping to multiply and germinate these types of local habitats is so important.
Can you give us, pardon me, can you give us some examples of the seed types you're talking about? I mean, you mentioned milkweed. What are some of the other key actors in this, creating these pathways and restoring the relationship between the wild areas and the cultivated areas?
Right. So there's I studied permaculture for a while, and I'm a permaculture teacher, and, you know, there's a lot of biomimicry that goes into restoration work, and we want to mimic the patterns that we see in nature, which is why these edible forest gardens or these multi-trophic layered gardens are so important, where you have the ground covers and the shrubs, and hopefully we'll get to be able to work with trees in the future. But as I was saying before, we really have been trying to pay attention to successional bloom times. So the more funding that the Ecotype Project gets, the more we're able to bring new species online, because taking seeds from botanists to founder plots to nurserymen, there is some cost that's incurred there. So what we've been able to do with our initial species that we've brought on, we have about 14 now, is making sure that we're covering those different habitat areas, those different bloom times, and also those different height levels, because different pollinators need different heights for overwintering and nesting and feeding. So we have some beautiful pycnanthemums, which are the mountain mints. We have Monarda, which is the wild bergamot. We have Vernonia.
Let's go slower, because these are new words to everybody. So you said mountain mint. Was that the generic name?
Yep, the narrow leaf mountain mint, pycnanthemum.
Okay. And then the next one was?
The next one was, we have the bergamot.
Bergamot.
The Monarda fistulosa.
And what are these things? What are they? Leafy plants, or are they floral plants? What?
I mean, they're basically herbs, right?
Well, you know what, there are a lot of like medicinal and culinary properties that they do have, but what these, the Monarda has a beautiful purple flowering, like other bergamots that are cultivated, has that beautiful purple flowering head, and they're quite tall, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Up above your hip. And the mints stay a bit lower, and they have smaller, less showier flowers, little white flowers. And then we have a beautiful penstemon that has a gorgeous white flower. We have a yarrow that we're working with. We have the Vernonia, which is the New York ironweed, which is now well above my head. In terms of seed cultivation, we're working on pruning them back so that we'll be able to when we're cultivating the seed, have them be lower and facilitate easier collections. But the ironweed is gorgeous, this, you know, burst of purple. Then the Joe Pye weed that we're working with also gets very tall and has those beautiful pink flowering heads. So those are some of the species that we're working with now. And now I'm in the process of doing the huge seed collection. And then we got this really cool machine called the Winnow Wizard, a great organic farmer of note, Frank Morton out in Oregon, who's an amazing lettuce seed breeder. He has a gentleman on his farm who, after looking at the technology available for seed cleaning, said he's going to invent his own. And so he invented something called the Winnow Wizard, which we're really excited to have because it'll definitely help facilitate when you break apart the pappus. So like when you see a dandelion seed floating on the wind, that helicopter white pappus that helps it with the animalcery, that's its wind dispersal mechanism. So when you clean the seed, you're rubbing that away from it. And that's a really fun kind of Sherlock Holmes process of how you clean each of the different seeds and then go into stratification and all those other fun facets of making sure that your wild seeds will actually germinate. But the good thing about these plants is they're weeds, right? Which is not a derogatory term because we love the weeds and we love eating them, but it's saying that they want to grow. And so given a little time and attention and care, they really do quite well on the land.
And we're speaking with Sephra Alexander. She is leading a seed saver project to promote biodiversity and sustainability. And she's, are you still in Vermont at the moment?
Nope, I'm currently collecting seed over at the Founders Plots at the great organic, the Hickory Farm here in Ridgefield, Connecticut. So I'm back because all of these plant seeds are well ripe to be harvested. You know, this is such a great time of year for harvesting seed. And for anyone who hasn't harvested seed before, there's so many great resources. Susan Ashworth's book, Seed to Seed. But even on the internet, you know, my friend Petra at Fruition Seeds, she gives a lot of tutorials. It's just amazing, you know, the interaction of humans with your land. Like when you have a tomato that you love, save that seed and you'll have that very same delicious tasting tomato that you've selected for color and vigor forever if you caretake it. So I really have a lot of reverence for seed saving and seed stewardship because there are these, you know, magic hibernating embryos that represent all of the stewardship before us and all of the biodiversity that's going to be available ahead of us. So we're really at this pinch of time when it's so important to be caretakers of the biodiversity.
And Sephra has a website, probably a couple of websites, but the one I was looking at is called seedhuntress.com, and that has links to interesting things, including a really cool short video of a conversation with a Haitian farmer who has really great insights into this whole issue. Can you talk, actually, let me, before I blather on here, let me check in with Guy, because I don't know if you know Guy Beardsley. He's the man that actually got us connected here through Dina Brewster at CT NOFA.
But, here I am.
Yeah, Guy, who has a small but very vibrant organic farm in Shelton, Connecticut. Guy, how do you process what Sephra's been saying? And Sephra, what do you have to say to Guy specifically about, if you know his farm, about, you know, how this all this stuff pertains to his project?
I've sort of taken a lot of my cues from Vincent Kay, who, of course, is a beekeeper, and he's pointing out the different kinds of flowers, particularly, that his bees really like, for not only for pollination, but for getting the honey. And this is, we're keeping actually a portion of the flower, portion of our gardens here in wildflowers, because his points was that, you know, his bees get some, a lot of really good pollen from the wildflowers. But so we just tried that this year because of what Vincent has been talking about, and Janelle and my son-in-law have been involved with. Now, they raise primarily and concentrating on lavender. Of course, that's good too, because the bees will just live in the lavender. But I'm not sure this is along the lines that Sephra is talking about. But I really wanted to ask her, if somebody wants to save tomato seeds, tell me the sequence that you would go to get them from the tomato plant or the tomato fruit into what you could plant next year.
Great question.
Great question. And, Guy, it's a pleasure to be in your presence here. You're a legend in your own right. So I can't wait to come see your farm. But
Well, you're welcome, too, anytime. Right.
And just before tomatoes, just a quick shout out for anyone who's beekeeping. I studied with the great mycologist, which is a study of mushrooms, Paul Stamets, and he's doing a lot of really interesting work about mycelium water. So mycelium is, you know, we have the internet, which is the World Wide Web, but the wood wide web of the forest, which connects all the plants and shares nutrients, is the mycelium, the fruiting bodies of which are mushrooms. And they have lots of antibacterial and antiviral properties. So bees normally would have a lot of their hives in rotting trees, which has mycelium that runs through it and dew in the morning. So what they found is bees not having that mycelial dew to feed on, that's what makes them more vulnerable and susceptible to a lot of other diseases. So he's been working on making bee feeders of mycelium water. So that's Paul Stamets. He wrote a great article in Nature magazine about it. So just a little plug for that. But for tomatoes, what do seeds need to germinate? Well, they need moisture and darkness, actually. What is the inside of a tomato seed? Pretty moist and dark. So why aren't those seeds sprouting? Well, wait, before
you go there, Sephra, how do you get them from the tomato itself into a seed that you would have ultimately plant?
Well, you find a tomato that tastes really delicious, and you just take a spoon and scoop out those jelly sacks of seeds into like a little mason jar.
Okay, so that's starting point. Then what's next?
Okay, so after you said, I really like the taste of this tomato and I like the way it looks, I'm going to scoop these seeds into a little jar. That gel-like surrounding of those seeds, it has anti-germination properties, right? Because it's protecting those seeds from germinating inside your tomato, or you could have a bunch of tomato sprouts coming out of your tomato. So what you need to do is a quick fermentation. And so you fill that little jar with just as much water as there is kind of gel around the tomato, so it's not too much. Mm. And then you leave it for 2 or 3 days. And what you're going to see is a mold form. And that mold is good, because what that mold does is it's eating away that gel that's around those seeds. So after that mold forms and the gel dissipates, you just wash the seeds in a colander with cool water. You want to make sure you have something underneath it to catch any of the seeds. And any of the seeds that float anyway are not viable, so you don't need those. And then you just put those sheets out on like a sheet tray, maybe with some parchment paper, and you put it in a nice, warm, dry place. You want it to be out of the sun, because the sun kind of crisps up those volatile oils. And after those seeds are nice and dry, you put them in a seed envelope or a jar, and as long as you keep those seeds cool, dark, and dry, that's kind of the mantra, cool, dark, dry. Those seeds should be ready to go for you next season.
Nicely done. That is from A to D.
A to seed.
great description of what we need to do to get those tomatoes from a delicious treat into producing more of them for the following year.
Sephra, how about if you wanted to save any seeds from, say, a winter squash, what would the procedures be on that?
So my expertise has become definitely more of like these perennial natives, and that's, again, where I would direct everyone to a Petra of Fruition Seeds. She has tutorials and YouTubes and everything you can imagine that goes through every crop that you can imagine. But as I understand it, you're supposed to leave the winter squash on the vine, so it almost the ones that get even drier and shrivel up, I think they almost go past their point of perfectness, And then you scoop those seeds out and dry them out, and they're pretty much ready to go. But
is it the same process if you put these in this water solution and they float up the top, you throw those out? That sounds like a great idea.
I think generally any seeds that float, that shows that they're not viable, but I think that's for wet processing. So that fermentation process is just for seeds that have that jelly-like consistency around it.
Yeah, it would seem that pumpkin and squash, those seeds are much more, they have a hard encasement. And basically, would you want to clean them up or just spread them out on a drying sheet with all their kind of slimy little remainder of the squash?
I think you get them as clean as you can, but I think you can just dry those out. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. You know, nature wants to live, and it's amazing to think that these seeds are just these hibernating embryos, right? I mean, there's been squash seeds. There's an amazing woman, Winona LaDuke, who saved seeds, and she's germinated seeds that are hundreds of years old. And there's, you know, stories of seeds that germinated after thousands of years. So as long as you get them clean enough and you just make sure you dry them out and keep them cool, dark, and dry, you're gonna pretty much have germination. I'm looking up. I actually have Susan Ashworth's book here, so I'm making sure I'm not speaking improperly about squash.
While you're doing that, I wanted to put a question out to you. You can bat it away if you don't want to deal with it. But what about this issue of these giant food combines like
Monsanto,
Cargill, and the kinds of patenting that they are doing on a lot of native plants, and also the fact that their seeds are considered
intellectual property.
Thank you. And that cannot be exchanged or passed on without paying Monsanto and other huge companies like that. How is that impacting the kind of work that you do?
Well, instead of, you know, grassroots organizations, I work with a lot of seed roots organizations, and I just joined as a board member on the Freed Seed Foundation, and there's a lot of great seed organizations that are saying the true empowerment, you know, there's a lot that goes on with patent protected seeds and all that, but if we get these open pollinated varieties, these OPVs, and the more of us that are growing them and saving our own seed, the less we have to rely on those larger conglomerates. So from everyone that I work with, instead of a doom and gloom kind of outward facing look, you know, where I personally come from the school of thought that it's too late to be pessimistic. And what we need to be doing is making sure that when we order from seed catalogs, that we're not ordering seeds that have patents on them. And then just inspiring as many of those around us to participate in these seed-saving, bioregional adaptations, beautiful, it's a beautiful art, really. And there's a lot of great places. I revived the Southport globe onion seed. There's a famous allium heirloom from where I'm from in Southport, Connecticut. There was a blight, and it got wiped out, and I got the seeds from Baker Creek heirloom seed. They still had it, but it hadn't been grown back in Southport in 130 years, so I grew it back. Takes 2 years. Onions are biennial, so they don't flower till the second year. And then after I saved that seed, I started a seed library at the Pequot Library in Southport. And that was a way that people can, just like a book, you check out seeds, you plant them in your garden, and then when you get seeds, like you would return a book, you return a little bit of those seeds so other people in the community can have it. And the more that we do, you know, you hear about watersheds, but what we're trying to do is really trying to promote seed sheds. So the more of us that are saving and sharing seeds locally, the less we have to rely on these larger corporations. And the seeds that we then save and share, they're going to do better because they're adapted to our climates, again, and our pests, and for our taste, and that have been selected for place. So that's my stance on that.
Nicely said. Thank you. That's wonderful. That's a resource that I knew nothing about. So tell us a little bit more about the Southport. It's at the Southport Library, or is it a separate facility that just deals with seeds?
Yep. If you go to the Southport Library and you go downstairs in the basement, there's an old card catalog, and you open that up, and there's a bunch of free seeds that you can. I have a little logbook in there that you sign it out. But wherever you are, actually a ton of the local libraries. The Fairfield Library has a great seed library. The Westport Library. I think that the Richfield Library is. They keep popping up now, and so it's becoming a more common thing. There's this wonderful woman, Rebecca Newman, who has, I think it's seedlibraries.com or something, and it has all the great resources that you would need if you wanted to start a seed library in your own town. So I've worked, I've done a lot of disaster response, food security relief work. That was that seed bank that I fortified down in Haiti, and have done work in Puerto Rico afterwards. So I have great relationships with a lot of these great seed companies like High Mowing, that have given me donations in the past for that type of seed sovereignty, food security work. And then they also donate to seed libraries. You kind of just pay for shipping and so forth. So it's really fun. And if you want to start a seed library, you can reach out to me and I can help direct you, or check with your local library and see if they already have one.
Beautiful. And as we approach the last minutes of the show, as you said, if people wanted to reach out to you, what's the best way to be in contact with you to get more information about all the great things you've been talking about? We had to sort of express route through a lot of this conversation today. We'd love to do some more of this with you. But how can people reach you and other resources that are relevant to this conversation?
Well, my website again is seedhuntress.com. On the perennial hunt to safeguard the biodiversity of our wild and cultivated lands. My email is just theseedhuntress@gmail.com. If you want to know more about the Ecotype Project, you can look up, it's on the CT NOFA website, so ctnofa.org/ecotypeproject. The botanical expedition, I'll link through my website. But for those of you who really want to know soup to nuts about seed saving, my dear friends at the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance, they lead something called Seed School, and they now offer a seed school online. So A to Z, everything you could want to know, from beginner seed saving to starting your own seed company. Bill McDormand and Bell Starr are great mentors of mine, and they're who I learned from. So, again, I would look up Seed School through the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance, and they will be able to speak to any questions that you might have
for that.
So those are, and then again, the book, the kind of the reference book that everyone uses is Seed to Seed by Susan Ashworth. And again, for videos and tutorials about seed saving, I would look to Fruition Seeds. They do an excellent job and have a wonderful selection of Northeast adapted varieties of seeds. So, yeah.
Well, thank Sephra. This has been a really inspiring conversation. So great to meet you orally, so to speak. And we hope that someday, given that you're pretty much locally based here, maybe in the distant future or not so distant future, you'll actually be here with us in the studio. It's been a great conversation with Sephra Alexander on the Organic Farm Stand. Guy Beardsley, delightful to hear you again, and glad
Absolutely.
That you're plowing on, so to speak. And Chris Ferriero, excellent that you were here. Thanks so much for filling in for me recently.
Sure.
And
thanks a lot, Sephra. It was very informative.
Thank you all, and thank you for the amazing content that you've been putting out for over a decade. It's definitely something I've been referencing and learned from over the years. So a real privilege.
Our pleasure and our privilege to be speaking with you. Thanks all. Come back in 2 weeks. We'll be here the first Thursday of October.
Which is the 1st of October.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks, Guy.
Talk to you soon.
Okay. Thank
you.
This world we're
Bye-bye.
Living in gets crazier by the day. Yes, it do. And the companies are throwing us. You know what they're doing? They're throwing us a chemical bouquet.
This is the Gaiagram, environmental headlines from around a planet in crisis.
Temperatures in Los Angeles surged to 121 degrees the first Sunday in September, the highest reading ever recorded in the city, as the West Coast grappled with a dangerous heat wave. The National Weather Service said the temperature observed at Woodland Hills Station is 2 degrees higher than the previous record set in 2006. The Mojave Desert Fire in August destroyed the heart of a beloved Joshua tree forest. The Mojave wildfire burned one of the world's largest forests of Joshua trees, charring more than 1.3 million trees. Most of the charred trees are still standing. In the evening light, their leaves bleached with scorch take on an eerie beauty. But they are doomed, and the 43,273 acres of the Dome Fire are forever transformed. Karachi, with a population of 15